All right, everybody, good afternoon. Let's get going. I wanted to have your exam graded for today, but it just didn't happen. I have an exam in my other class, too, so when they fall together like that, it's really tough to get them back right the next time. So I will have it graded sometime over the weekend, and I'll enter the scores in D2L so you can see how you did. The answer key is up in D2L right now, so you can just look at that if you remember what you did on some of them. So, I always put a blank up in there too, one that's just the same as what you took, during the exam time. So you can use that for practice. So print that out and work those problems as if it was the exam. So if you had trouble with something, go review it up a little bit and try it out and sort of test yourself again, because all of these things that we learned in the first three chapters are things that will continue to come up over and over again as we apply it to the rest of the stuff. So if you had trouble with any of the stuff in exam one, it doesn't just go away. You have to learn how to do it if you want to continue to be able to do the rest of the stuff. So I have 4, 5, and 6 assignments up in Mastering Chemistry, so you've got a while to do the chapter 4 assignment to the end of next week. So we'll be doing chapter 4 today and through next week, so you'll be able to finish it then. You'll have a while then before the 5 and 6 ones are due. Give you a little reminder about lab report due dates. The experiment that we did on Monday, its report will be due a week from next Monday, so you have 2 weeks from that. And then the one we'll do next Monday will be due 2 weeks from that, too. So we'll go 2 weeks out for the next couple of them, and then we'll get back on track. We'll see. I'll show you how that'll work in a little while, but that's what you need to know for now. Anybody have questions about any of that business? So I'll have exam scores in D2L sometime Saturday, Sunday, something like that. I'll send out an email when I get scores up, so you don't have to keep checking. Just wait for an email. One thing I do want to say, though, it's been a little odd this year. I've had far more complaints about lab partners not pulling their weight than I have in other years. Normally, there's maybe one or two people in the section that's not pulling their weight, that's not being a good partner. This time, I've heard a lot more complaints than usual, and I don't know if it's me not impressing upon you the importance of being a good lab partner or what, but I will remind you that at the end of this semester, the whole last 5-6 weeks or so we're spending, it will be a laboratory project where you choose your own partners. Okay? Think about this a little bit. What if you're a terrible partner all throughout the semester, and then we end up with this huge laboratory project where somebody has to agree to have you in their group? What are the implications if you're a crummy partner? Right? Nobody's going to want to work with you, right? It is to your benefit to be the best partner that you can be so that people will want to work with you. Okay? I've had it happen, usually, like I said, it's not more than one or two problem students or so. But I've had it happen where one student was so bad throughout the semester that all the groups refused to have that person work with them, and they had to do a lab project on their own. And since they were such a crummy lab partner, they didn't know how to write lab reports and how to keep their notebook up, and they got an awful grade on the lab project too. So if you want to be in a good group, and if you want to have a good project that's worth 50 points, I think, it's not an insignificant chunk of change in this course. It is really to your benefit to work well with your partner. That means you're not waiting until half hour before the lab is due to give your give your portions back to your partner to review. Okay? That means working on it throughout the week that you did the report. Okay? You're going back and forth several times so that you can each catch each other's mistakes and so on. the people that have all come to talk to me about issues with lab partners, I've told them if this continues that they should come to talk to me while the report is still active, and if I'll intervene, it's not going to be pretty. Okay? You're going to end up both doing your own work and nobody's going to be happy. The other thing that can happen if somebody lets me know that their partner is not pulling their weight, if we identify the portions that that partner was responsible for, then only they will feel the consequences. Okay? That's not an option that I like to do an awful lot, because it's important that you be able to make the group dynamic work. The reason we have different groups and the reason we work in groups all together is because any potential employer that any of you would be seeking, right, if you're taking this class, expects not only that you'd be able to have, you know, be able to do some science, but you need to be able to work with others, and you need to be able to work with others that you may not choose to normally work with. So having that, I mean, that's almost as important of a skill to have in the modern workforce now. And any employer will tell you that. So if you're screwing your lab partner, you're doing yourself a major disservice by, you might be saving a little time now, but it's really going to come back to bite you when you really need to have those skills to be able to have, hold down any kind of decent job and be successful later on. Okay? So keep that in mind. Consider that a major warning to those of you, and you know who you are, if you have waited till the last minute to get stuff back to your partner, if you have not contributed to your report, things are going to get really ugly if that continues. Okay? Everybody understand that? Give me a nod at least. Okay? So, let's get right into chapter 4. We're right on schedule here. We need to start the next chapter after our exam. So, chapter 4 is about stoichiometry and aqueous reactions. So, we talked a little bit about reactions at the end of chapter 3. We learned how to balance and how to write phase labels and stuff like that. But now let's use the calculations we learned about in chapter 3 along with chemical reactions, something that we haven't really done yet. Okay? So let's start this chapter with stoichiometry. It's just the study of amounts of substances based on a balanced chemical equation, okay, or a chemical reaction. So what amount of this reacts with that? Okay? How much of this do you need to make that? If you have excess of this, how much of the other reactant is left over, for instance? All of those are stoichiometry issues whenever we're talking about amounts of reactants and products. So I have a chemical equation right here that is unbalanced. You've all got practice balancing. Why don't you just take a second and balance that one? I always thought balancing equations was kind of fun. It's like a crossword puzzle or a Sudoku or something like that. So, what do you think? We're going to have 8, 9. Looks like I'll have an odd number of oxygens at one point in it. You know, one way to think about balancing also, if you ever get stuck or if you're checking your work or something, is look at the stuff where there's only one of it on each side, right? So look at carbon. There's only one place there's carbon on the left and only one place there's carbon on the right. So those two coefficients have to be a certain ratio in order for carbon to be balanced. And hydrogen is only once on one side. So those two coefficients have to be a certain ratio in order for those to be balanced. So oxygen, the one that's on its own, is what you can fill in last in order to make it work. Okay? So is this one where you had to sort of double out a fraction in order to get whole numbers or not? Did you Whole number is the first sin. Yeah, I think this is when you have to double it out. So if you had 1 and 8 for carbon originally, you'd now have 2 and 16. 2 times 18, right? For hydrogens. Then what do you put in front of oxygen? 25 is what I got. Okay? So that looks balanced to me. You would have had 1, 25 halves, 8 and 9, in order to get the right number of oxygens, but you'd double it out to make whole numbers. Okay? So that's balancing. We've all done it. It should be familiar to us at this point. One way of interpreting those coefficients we wrote is to think of that as how many molecules there are. So if I had, for instance, 2 of those CaH18 molecules, how many oxygen molecules would those two react with? 25. That's right. And how many CO2s would be produced? 16 and 18 water molecules. Okay? That's the molecular interpretation of a balanced chemical equation. Okay? If I just had 2 of those and 25 of those, literally if I had that number of molecules, that's how many product molecules would be produced. Okay? It's one way to think of it. That's never going to actually happen. Okay? You're never going to have a container with just 2 of these molecules and 25 oxygen molecules. Right? We tend to think of things in large groupings of molecules much more often, and that's what moles are for. But remember, a mole is just a certain grouping of a certain number of things. So whatever I did with individual molecules themselves, I can have that same relationship with the groupings as well. If a recipe calls for, if a recipe calls for 1 egg, and I make 12 times that recipe, I can use a dozen eggs. Right? If a recipe called for 4 eggs, and I do 12 times that recipe, I'll use 4 dozen eggs. Okay? So if I have a certain grouping that I'm using to count with, I can just think of that. So think of it this way. If I have 2 moles of C8H18, how many moles of O2 will that react with? Yeah, 25. That'll produce 16 moles of CO2 and 18 moles of H2O. Now, those are values that are useful to us. Even if we don't have exactly 2 moles of C8H18 and 25 moles of oxygen, this at least tells us what ratio of those substances are required to react. So I will always need a 2 to 25 ratio if I want both of those to react completely. Or if I react 2 moles of C8H18, I'll make 16 moles of CO2. It's always going to be that 2 to 16 or that 1 to 8 ratio if this one over here reacted completely to form product. So that's the usefulness of this. We can use these to construct, what did we call that when I converted from moles of one thing to moles of another? A mole ratio. It's probably in a sentence down here somewhere. Yeah, down at the bottom. I can use coefficients from a balanced equation to make a mole ratio. This is our key to how much of one thing makes how much of another thing, and so on. So anytime our calculation involves one thing and another thing, we're going to use a mole ratio that comes from the balanced chemical equation. So let's do this one together. Treat it just like a unit conversion, where if I've given you that one measurement, CaH18, and if I want to know how many moles of CO2 can be produced, I'm going to use coefficients to make a mole ratio. So what should I put on the bottom of this fraction? 2 moles. Exactly. Okay. And those 2 moles of C8H18 will correspond with what? 16 moles. Okay. Coefficients that we used for balancing are exact numbers. So coefficients do not limit our significant figures. Mole ratio has no impact. The measurement we started with does, so our answer needs two significant figures. What'd you get? Somebody get an answer? 70? So if I wanted to write 70 with two sig figs, in standard notation like this, what would I do? Yeah, if I had 70 with a dot, that would work. If I wanted to be really sure no one would mistake how many sig figs I'm trying to say, what could I write that 70 as? Which would be what, 7?
0.
In this case, both of those are correct. If I had 70 without a dot, that would not be showing the right number of sig figs. At least it would be unclear how many were shown. Okay, so I'll leave our mole ratios up there. Here's a question where I've given you grams of octane, and octane is the C8H18. Okay? If I react that certain mass of octane, I want to know how many grams of CO2 can be produced from the combustion of octane. You notice this is a combustion reaction. We talked about those a little bit. I have octane plus O2 making CO2 and H2O. We talked about combustion a little bit last time. So what sequence do you have to do when you have grams of one thing and you're solving for grams of another thing? Yeah. Grams to moles to moles to grams. Okay? So I won't make you move too far today. Two groups there. Three back there. You want to just scoot over and talk to those three this time? Because I can have those three and then these four. And you're the only one who has to do as much. Okay? There we go. So, work this one out. Compare it with your group members. Assume somebody has a periodic table in your group. Yeah. Alrighty, so most of you are most of the way there. Still see a little punching away happening, but remember I said we do grams to moles to grams. What is the kind of conversion factor that converts from one substance to another substance? Yeah, the mole ratio is the only conversion factor that takes us from one thing to another thing, one chemical formula to a different chemical formula. Where does the mole ratio appear in our string of conversion factors for this problem? Yeah. If you do three conversions, the mole ratio will be in the middle. What kind of conversions are on either side of the mole ratio when we do something like this? Yeah, we use molar mass. So I will assume that we're starting with 4.50. It's 10 to the 4 grams of octane. So it's a molar mass you use for that first one, okay? Somebody in the back over here to my right, what molar mass did you get? 114.2. So does that go in the top or the bottom? 114. I got 224 grams of octane, and that's per what?
Mole of octane.
Yeah. So there's a molar mass. Now comes the mole ratio. What did you put on the bottom of the mole ratio? Guys in back there.
2 moles of octane.
Yep.
And then 16 moles of carbon dioxide on the top.
2 moles of octane per 16 moles of CO2. There's always somebody that asks if that can be simplified to 8 to 1, and I say, yeah, it can be, but why not just leave it like that, because you'll be looking back at your problem later and you won't figure out where that 8 came from, because there is no 8 in your balanced chemical equation. So why not just leave those as the coefficients so you can go back and troubleshoot and verify that you did indeed use the right numbers. Okay. Well, not a huge deal, but it's a tip anyway. What did you put, folks in the middle here, what did you put on the bottom of your third fraction?
1 mole CO2.
All right. And what's the molar mass of CO2?
44.1.
Okay. Do you folks in front get an answer? Right. If I do a little conversion in my head, if I want that in kilograms, I'd take the power of 10 down by 3. Right? So 1.39 times 10 to the 2 kilograms, that's 139 kilograms of CO2. Something like that. You guys in the front here, figure out why I would have asked a question like this one, where you would find 4.5 times 10 to the 4 grams of octane. Just think about that. No?
Gasoline engine.
Oh, gasoline engine. Okay. 45 kilograms of octane might be about how much, I don't know, I just estimated, but that's a normal gas tank might hold about 45 kilograms of gasoline. So, in your car, are we paying attention back over here, please? Thank you. So, in your car, when you have it filled up with gasoline and you've gone through an entire tank of gas, you have produced 139 kilograms of carbon dioxide that's been put into the atmosphere. So, this will be a common theme that we'll come back to, but it's, you know, even, you know, it's almost 10 times, you know, 4 times 13, 40, you know, 5, 4 times 3. It's like 3 times as much mass as the gas that we put in, okay, is being produced as carbon dioxide that's going into the atmosphere. So it makes sense. That's just 1 gallon, or that's just 1 tank of gas that you've used. Think of all the cars on the road and all the trucks on the road and all the trucks that are shipping everything from everywhere and all the everything else that's burning gasoline and other fossil fuels and so on, and you get an idea as to why an industrial revolution could cause the concentration of carbon dioxide to increase appreciably. Now, the atmosphere is really, really big. Atmosphere is huge, but just 1 tank of gas puts a really significant amount of carbon dioxide into it. So this will be a common theme that we'll come back to, but this is a calculation that one could do if they wanted to figure out, you know, carbon footprint, that sort of stuff, how many tons of CO2 you're producing by a month worth of commuting or something like that. And the number is in tons of CO2 per person.
You should probably figure out how much carbon dioxide it needs to convert back to oxygen.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We can do that. It happens that there was an equilibrium with CO2 being produced and CO2 being consumed by the trees before the Industrial Revolution came along. So nature was doing just great with that balance, but then we started burning fossil fuels and not nearly enough trees to take care of it. Okay? So that's a simple gram to mole to gram calculation, where you're just given grams of one thing and you're asked about grams of any other thing in that reaction. That's all you have to do. Okay? In that one, we had a reactant making a product. I could ask you how much one reactant will react with another reactant. Right? So if I have 10 grams of this, how many grams of this will react with it? That's the same calculation. Okay? Anytime it's grams to grams within a equation. Okay? But whenever amounts of more than one reactant are known, we must first find the limiting reactant. So these are the things that we ask ourselves. Which reactant is consumed first? Okay. whenever I have two different reactants, unless I have absolutely perfect amounts of each, where they would both consume all at the same time, that never happens. Okay? There's always going to be, you know, maybe one extra molecule of one of them or something like that. So statistically, we never consider that situation. So essentially, there will always be one reactant that is in excess of the other. Okay? What we do is we'll calculate the moles of a single product that each reactant would make. So I'm saying if this reactant were used up, how much product would that make? If this other reactant were used up, how much product would it make? Okay? And the reactant that makes the fewer product moles is the limiting reactant. We cannot just look at the reactants themselves to tell which one will get used up for a lot of reasons. Okay? The coefficients could be such that we only need a little bit of one per a lot of the other to react. Even if the coefficients were the same, their molar masses are going to be different. Okay? So there's a lot of things to consider, but it gets very simplified if all we do is calculate how much product can be made from that one. Okay? If you've got something that could on its own make a lot of product versus something that could on its own only make a little product, the one that can make a little bit of product is going to be the one that's used up first, right? Think about that. There's always an analogy of building, you know, building something in a factory or something. I used to use the example of an automobile assembly line, where if one person on the line ran out of their parts, the whole assembly line stopped. But that was until somebody that actually worked at an assembly line told me that if somebody runs out of their thing, they just do other things. The whole thing doesn't come grinding to a halt. But that is what happens in a chemical reaction. If we run out of one of the reactants, then no more reaction can happen. Okay? So the one we run out of is the important one for determining product. Okay? So the reactant that makes the fewer product moles, we call that the limiting reactant. That's the one that runs out. And that's how many product moles can actually be formed in the reaction. So that's a lot of jabbering about this. Let's do this example together, and then let's do a couple of these together, and then I'll set you off. Okay? So this is a moles to moles calculation. Okay? I want to know how many moles of H2 can be formed. Okay? So that's our product. Okay? But in this case, I've given you moles of both of the reactants. 0.30 moles of zinc, 0.52 moles of HCl. So if I started out with 0.30 moles of zinc, what is it that I told you we could do to figure out which one will get used up first? I can calculate what? Yeah. I can convert that to the product that we're interested in. Okay? So if I'm in moles of zinc, what will I use to get into the product we're interested in? What kind of conversion factor? A mole ratio is what we use any time we go from one thing to another thing. So what's the mole ratio of zinc to H2 in this one? 1:1, right? 1 mole of zinc per 1 mole of H2. So that means I could produce 0.30 moles of H2. But I would only produce 0.30 moles of H2 if what happened to this zinc? Yeah, if this zinc fully reacted. Okay? We don't know that yet. I have one more thing to do. What should I start with on my other thing to do here? I'm going to start with 0.52 moles of the other reactant I was given. What will I put on the bottom of its mole ratio?
2.
There's HCl. 2 moles of HCl per what?
All right.
So it's 0.52 divided by 2.26. Okay. I've got two answers here. How many moles of H2 can be formed if I react those two things together? 2.6. Okay. Think about this. If my HCl fully reacted, I could make 0.26. If my zinc fully reacted, I could make 0.30. What does that tell you about these two? Which one's going to run out first?
HCl
runs out first. So, in this reaction, is it even possible to form 0.30 moles of that product? No. So what I really like to do is make a big X through that one, through that product amount that's bigger, because we cannot produce that. As soon as I hit 0.26 moles of the product, HCl runs out, and what happens to the reaction? It stops. It's over. No more HCl means no more reaction. Okay? As soon as you run out of the first one, reaction stops. Okay? Right here, the smaller of our masses, or of our moles there, this is how much can be produced. Okay. So, it's very important that you understand this concept. If you took a chemistry class before, you may have just did grams, moles, and moles of grams, pick the smallest number, and that's your answer. Okay? You may have memorized that algorithm to use. Okay? It's very important at this point that you understand, even at the fundamental here, where we're just going moles to moles, it's important that you understand when one runs out, reaction stops.
I was just wondering if the question were about the zinc, Zn, Cl2, and hydrogen, mm-hmm. Would you just do it for both of them then?
Mm-hmm.
Would it be the same?
Yep.
Process?
Although, what's the mole ratio for Zn, Cl2, and H2? 1:1. So, if I can produce 0.26 moles of H2, how many moles of ZnCl2 could I also produce? The same. Yep. So what I would really do is have both of your reactants going to just one product, okay? And then if you're asked about another product, you could convert it from that one. Okay? Students can Students will sometimes even get into trouble by doing one product for one and another product for the other, but that's apple and oranges if their mole ratios aren't the same. Okay? So when you're doing this, you have to be comparing two of the same thing, or however many reactants you have. You have to be calculating into the same thing. And if the question is only which is the limiting reactant, then you could pick whichever product you wanted. It doesn't matter. But they have to be into the same one. Okay? So HCl runs out first. HCl is the limiting reactant. Okay. Questions? So, let's take that one step further. Let's calculate how much of the leftover reactant is left over. How much of the excess reactant is left over. So, which is the excess reactant?
Zinc.
Okay. You guys did this reaction in lab, right? A couple weeks ago. What did it look like when HCl was the limiting reactant? What did your container look like when it was finished? Yeah, there's pieces of zinc still floating around. Okay? What would it look like if zinc was the limiting reactant? Yeah, you'd just see a clear liquid. All of the zinc would have reacted and dissolved. So that's why you did that reaction, in order to be able to see which... to actually look at which one was left over. So, let's calculate the amount of zinc that's left over. We didn't do anything like this in the lab, but we could. Okay? You theoretically could have weighed your thing, your little test tube, after the reaction was done, I suppose, and figured out how much zinc was there. You would have to compensate for the hydrogen gas that was lost, though, so it's complicated. First, let's calculate the amount of excess reactant that was actually used. Okay? So, how am I going to do that? If I want to figure out how many moles, in this case, how many moles of zinc would actually be used in this reaction, what would I start with? Any ideas? Yeah. I mean, we went through this work up here to figure out how much product could be made. Okay. If I could make 0.26 moles of H2, I can sort of go back and figure out how much zinc it would take to make that. Right? And in this case, it'll be pretty easy. What should I use for a fraction here? Yeah. 1 mole of H2 per what? Ah. Okay. My answer to this was 0.2 moles of zinc. Is that how much zinc is left over? No. That's how much zinc was used. Okay. Okay. So, look at the last part of my sentence here. If I want to find out how much was left over, what should I do? Yeah. 0.30 moles of zinc is what we started with, minus 0.26 moles of zinc is what we used, equals 0.04 moles of zinc that will remain unreacted. Okay? So, this question was all in terms of moles. Okay? You should be able to master this kind of calculation, because it's the core of calculating it any other way. Okay? We could go grams to grams. Later on, we're going to go concentration to concentration. Okay? So, but this, what we did here with the mole ratio, this is going to be the core of everything we'll do. If I had grams of everything, I could have just as easily calculated how many grams were used and subtracted that from the grams that we started with to get grams left over. Same thing. Okay? So, let's give you a chance to try it. Here's one that's at its core the same as what we did on the last page. The difference here is that these are gram-to-gram calculations. Okay? So, what I would actually like you to do, though, is to do the limiting reactant where it's moles of this product versus moles of the product from the other thing. Okay? So you're going to end up with moles of ZNS and moles of ZNS, and you stop at that moles in order to figure out the limiting reactant. That's going to save us some time in a little bit. So what I want your first goal to be would be to have two values over here for your first two calculations. That's the hint I'll give you for that. And we'll stop when we get to that. So just figure those two out for now. I guess you could go on if you want, but we'll share once I see what most people have got. Moles from one and then moles from the other, and what you can get from that. Down in front over here to my left, what's the molar mass of zinc? Okay. In the back, what kind of mole ratio did you use? 8 to 8? Now remember I said, even if it's something that could be simplified, it's good to write it in your fraction. But does that mean you have to do times 8 divided by 8 in your calculator? No. All you guys said was 8 to 8. What did you get for moles for the first time? 0.113? Give me a couple more digits, because we're not done yet.
It's 11252.
11252? Something like that. Okay. Does that make sense for everyone else? Is that a familiar-looking number? 257? Probably depends on the molar mass you use, probably not a big deal. Okay? I'm assuming in the other one we started with 6.45 grams of S8. What the heck does S8 mean? 8 atoms of sulfur. Remember, sulfur is a molecular element. In one of its major forms, it's made out of rings of 8 sulfur atoms. So S8 is a common way of writing elemental sulfur. What'd you get for molar mass of S8? Back to my right. 256.6, something like that? Yes? Oh, no. Grams of S8 per mole. Okay. Then, you three of you in the very middle here, what mole ratio did you use? What on the bottom? One? One mole of S8 per 8. The MS. Okay.
Actually, it would, if you use 256 grams of S8, you'd be putting up moles of S.
Nope. You gotta be talk. You can't be changing the thing you're talking about.
Okay.
Okay. I'm talking about S8 here. I need to be talking about S8 here. If I wanted to talk about S, I would have to say I would have all ones for my mole ratios. And my molar mass would be just whatever sulfur was. So you would end up getting the same thing anyway. But you run into problems when you are inconsistent with the way that you're referring to it. So, and you can even see the math would work out. If I had this divided by 8 for just sulfur, then I would make 1 mole of S for 1 mole of ZNS. And the math would work either way. Okay. So, you guys in front get an answer for this one? Point. Two, zero, one, something. All right. Which of these is the real answer? Top one. Point 201 cannot form because what happens before we get to that point? Yeah, we run out of zinc, which is the limiting reactant. All right. We'll see in a second why I had to stop at moles and not just go to grams. Okay? We do need to go into grams to answer our first question. So let's do that. Point 11257. Anybody get a molar mass for ZNS yet? Zinc sulfide. Yep. What was it exactly? 97.45. Yeah. Okay. So, how many grams of the product can be produced? Where am I at? You guys in the back, get one for grams. About 11 grams? No. Exactly 11 grams? Not exactly 11 grams either. 10.97? 96? How many significant figures should be in this answer?
10.969.
How many significant... So 10.9699, whatever, rounds to what? 11.
11.
Ah. Is 11.0 exactly 11 grams, though? Careful. Okay, that's one answer. Can be produced. Why do you suppose I stopped you at moles so we had a number for moles and didn't just chug all the way through to grams? Uh-huh, because we have to answer the second question. What mass of reactant remains? And to answer that second question, I should start with what? Should start with 0.11257. So, work that one out, start there. I would like you to get eventually what mass of reactant remains. So instead of just calculating the moles of excess that were used, you should calculate what? Yeah, you should calculate grams that were actually used. I think I got through most everybody on this side. Well, let's start simple. What mole ratio, you guys in front here, what mole ratio did you start with? What do you think? 1/8. So 8 moles CNS converted into 1 what? 1 mole. Why am I converting back into S8? That's a good question. Mm-hmm. Yep. Zinc is the limiting reactant, so at the end of the reaction it's used up. That means this one has some left over. Doing this calculation will tell us how much was actually used, okay, if I were to get that much product. But don't stop at moles. What did I tell you to keep going to get? Grams. So 1 mole of S8 already have that molar mass up here, right? 256.6, something like that. Is 256.6 the actual molar mass, or was that rounded?
That was rounded. It's 256.6.
5.6? So don't use rounded molar masses. That introduces error into your calculation. Keep all the numbers just right in your calculator. How many grams of S8 were used? Can we get one? 3.1. Somewhere around 3.6, apparently. That's not the answer I'm looking for. I want to know how much is left over. So what should I do?
Subtract.
What from what?
The amount you started with minus the amount that you used.
I got 2.84. Does that look familiar? Does that look close anyway?
Yeah.
All right. So, just the same as the problem we did last time. The only additions were that we started with grams, so we had one step before we got into moles, okay? And then we had to do moles into grams for this, we had to do moles into grams for that. So, anywhere we had moles, we have a gram step latched onto it, okay? But it's very important to recognize that at the core of this problem is that mole conversion that we did on the last page. Okay? I can always tell students that have memorized a specific sequence of steps to do a problem, because if on an exam I went back to ask what I would expect to be a simple mole-to-mole calculation, students like that wouldn't know what to do. So that's always a major trick in introductory chemistry classes. You know, we think a mole-to-mole calculation should be simple because it's just one step, but somebody that's memorized grams to moles to grams doesn't know how to do that. So it's important that you know the core, that you be able to add on molar masses if you're dealing with grams. But it's still fundamentally a mole calculation. Okay? Questions about this? Let's see here. It's unreacted. Let's make a label. Okay. Theoretical yield and actual yield. Theoretical yield is something we already did. That is a calculated product mass from a stoichiometry calculation. Okay. So what is our theoretical yield from the previous problem? 6.1 grams? No.
It's 0.11257.
Moles? Right here. Theoretical yield is the amount of product in grams that we could get if I could get 11 grams of that product if what happened? Yeah, if everything reacted? Not everything, I have S8 left over. If all of the limiting reactant was used up, okay, I would be able to get, at an upper limit, 11.0 grams of product. Okay? A good way of saying that is no more than 11.0 grams, for instance. Okay? So I kind of like referring it to that way. Okay. That is the upper limit as to how much product can be formed. Okay? Is it common in the laboratory to get exactly as much as that we could? Probably not. There's a billion things that can get in the way of getting all of the theoretical yield. Okay? If you have a reaction where you're transferring between containers, there's going to be some stuck to the side of the container. If you have a solid product, you have to scrape it out of the container and put it in a little vial, okay, and lose some of it that way. The reaction itself, a lot of times, doesn't even go to completion. Okay? We're making the assumption that the limiting reactant is totally unreacted, but that doesn't always happen. Okay? There's some reactions that don't finish on their own. So that's why this theoretical yield is an upper limit. Let's just write that. Upper limit. Those of you taking calculus have heard all you care to hear about upper limits, but this is an easy upper limit. So actual yield is a number that cannot be calculated. Actual yield comes from doing a reaction in the lab, scraping it out of the container, putting it on the balance, and measuring how much you actually got. Okay? That is a measured product mass from experiment. So what do you suppose? On an exam, does that mean I will ask you to be coming up with an actual yield? No, not unless you're doing a little reaction on your desk or something like that. In a question, I will say if this amount were actually produced. Something. Okay? So actual yield is almost always going to be given in the problem. Or if it's in the sake of lab, measured. Okay? How will the actual yield and theoretical yield compare with each other size-wise, then? Actual should be less than theoretical. Mm-hmm. And I didn't misspeak there. I wasn't being imprecise in my language either. Actual should be less than theoretical. What if you go do a reaction, you have a theoretical yield of 11 grams, and you measured out 11.5 grams of product. Have you created mass? Have you broken the law of conservation of mass? No? No? Double check your... But you could be measuring your mass right. You could have the tear correct and everything. Yes. You could have not purified your reaction. We had 2.84 grams of S8 that were left unreacted. Those don't just automatically separate themselves out from the product. You have to do a distillation or chromatography or something to actually separate it. Mm-hmm. Yep. A lot of times when you have a reaction, you have a solvent that has to be removed in order to have a purified product. So if you didn't remove all the water, if your product is still wet, you would get an artificially high yield. Okay? So if actual yield is too high, that just means you have an impure product. That's all there is to it. So if you ever go on to take organic chemistry, which is next year's chemistry class, smaller actual yield is actually better than an actual yield that's greater than the theoretical. Okay? Because not only do I know that something wasn't quite right, but I know that the product wasn't pure just by looking at how much they got. So percent is just what a percent should be. Since actual should be less, it'll be actual divided by theoretical times 100 to make a percent. So what percent of the theoretical yield did you actually capture? So let's do one quick. Say actual yield was 10.2 grams. Did this reaction in lab, got 10.2 grams of the product. I ran the reaction, I purified it, so I separated it from the unreacted starting material, which is important. A lot of people forget about that. What percent yield was it? That is an excellent percent yield. Okay. Anything over 90% is about as good as you can expect. A chemical plant working with huge containers of stuff where they can really get all of it out, and the losses are really minimal, can approach 98%, maybe even 99% if it's tremendously efficient. But really, anything over 90% is pretty good. The problem with that thinking is that a lot of times, if say you're in drug production or something like that, you'll have a series of chemical reactions that have to happen in order to go from starting material to product. So what if you've got 10 steps and each one of those is a 90% yield? Well, you'll start with 90% of your starting material, then 90% of that, then 90% of that, then 90% of that, then 90% of that. So that's why chemical synthesis is an expensive and usually pretty difficult proposition, and that's why running a reaction efficiently is important. So a percent yield question could be tacked on to any of these things that we've done today. Okay. You could even do a percent yield with moles. It'll give you the exact same answer because you're talking about the same substance. So, just before we go, let's just get a start on dealing with solutions, their concentration, and the calculations that we can do with them. We'll talk more about their calculations later on. Okay. In lab last time, was it last time? Or yeah, I think it was last time. Somebody asked me about what the capital M for the unit meant behind on the labels of all the chemicals you have. That was a concentration unit, and that's important because almost all of the reactions we'll be talking about in this course do not happen just by adding pure this to pure that. You have a solution. Right? You have some of one reactant dissolved in water and you add it to another solution. That's what you did in the reactions lab this week. All of those things in the bottles were mostly water, but they had some stuff dissolved in them, which was doing the reacting. So the concentration is important to consider. So any unit of concentration is usually going to be in the form of the amount of solute divided by the amount of solution. Okay? Solute is what? The thing that you dissolved. Okay. Solution is what? What you dissolved it in? First one. Yeah, okay. So let's make sure we get that right. Solute is what you're dissolving. Solution is what you end up with. What am I missing? Solvent. Solvent and solute add together to make solution. Okay? So solute is the thing that you are dissolving. Solvent is the stuff that you're dissolving it in. Solution is what you end up overall. So look at our numbers here. Amount of solute divided by amount of solution. Okay? Most concentration units, and I say most because there are exceptions, but most will be divided into how much solution total we have. Okay? So molarity is the most common concentration unit used in chemistry. So moles of solute per liters of solution. And it's important because moles are the core of any kind of calculation that we do, pretty much involving amounts of chemicals. So how many moles were dissolved in a liter of that solution is our molarity. So if I have a 0.50 molar, that's how that's pronounced, capital M used as a unit is pronounced molar, the molarity is the concentration itself. Okay? So a 0.50 molar, what's AgNO3? Silver nitrate, yeah, 0.50 molar silver nitrate solution, that's how it's pronounced. So if I had 1 liter of this solution, how many moles of silver nitrate would be dissolved in it? I'll give you a hint, you don't need a calculator. 0.50. Okay, that's by definition what that means. If I had a liter of that solution, it would contain 0.50 moles, Okay. I'll at least get you started thinking about this. We'll start with this calculation next time. But if I wanted to prepare a certain volume of a certain concentration solution, I'm going to use a given molarity as a conversion factor. So before we go, here's our given molarity, 0.10 molar. How can I turn that into a conversion factor? That capital M meant what per what? Moles per liter. So that means 0.10 what? 0.10. To make a conversion factor out of this, I need an actual fraction. A number on top and a number on the bottom. So if I had 0.10, what would its unit be? Moles per what? 1 liter of solution. So it's moles of silver nitrate. Okay? That's important. And this fraction can be inverted, but the number right here will always go next to the unit that it's attached to. So 0.010 moles per liter means to make a conversion factor out of it, we'll have 0.10 moles on one side, 1 liter of solution on the other side. Okay, so we're starting with this next time. Have a nice weekend. I don't think you have anything to do. That's weird, right? Next Monday? Monday or Wednesday? Yeah.
So we should all have a lab due
then? No, the one we're doing on Monday will be due 2 weeks from then. So we're 2 weeks out for the next couple of labs. So. Oh, my cocktail.
We kind of stuck on this one. This is the vinegar and baking soda.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking that one of these is supposed to have a kind of this one, but this one's supposed to have a different state.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I have solid there, but I wasn't sure.
Yep.
Because when I looked on the solubility, it said that that wasn't solid. But if it was combined with that...
Yeah, if it's combined with H+, you can't really do that. The deal here is that H2CO3, before you even break this into ions, H2CO3 itself becomes H2O and CO2. You know, there's two hydrogens and oxygen plus CO2. So if you replace that with H2O liquid and CO2 gas, that's where the gas produces.
So then that would basically go in where this is.
Yep.
H2O and CO. Okay.
Yep.
And then
any gas producing reactant will have an unstable product that decomposes into a gas as soon as it's formed.
Okay, because I kind of thought that there was supposed to be a gas in there.
One more thing that happens.
Bubbling,
yeah.
You know,
so you're correct in using the exchange reaction to make that, but it's unstable. It decomposes and forms water and carbon dioxide.
Okay, excellent.
So look ahead in this chapter. There's a section on gas-producing reactions that...
All right. Okay, thank you.